Well, today we come to Genesis chapter 1, and it seems like we're going kind of backwards, doesn't it? Revelation to Genesis, instead of Genesis to Revelation, but we'll start all over again, we're doing it. And when we studied Revelation, we realized that sometimes when it's a little bit confusing because so many really godly Christians do interpret it differently, and we accept that as, okay, I may not understand how they come to their conclusions, but I accept them as brothers and say, well, we just have a different understanding of this. And to a limited extent, you get the same thing in Genesis chapter 1. And I think we have to be kind of patient with each other there too. Let me just be really upfront here. I'm going to give some background stuff that I think is very important. I prayed a lot about this, and I feel like this is what the Lord wants me to share. It seems to me, personally, that the most straightforward way to understand Genesis 1 is to read it and interpret it very literally. It supports what I call young earth cosmology or young earth creationism. I'm a young earther. It concludes, that method of studying Genesis 1 concludes that when you see a day, it means, well, that's a day. It's a 24-hour day. They're literal days. And that God created things maybe thousands of years ago instead of millions or billions of years ago. It seems to me to be the most natural way to read the Bible. You know, if you just read it without knowing anything at all about science, I think that's the conclusion you'd probably come up with. Now, I feel like I need to point out that there are some problems with that. And there are some men out there, men of God, who see problems with it and who give those problems and therefore interpret it a little differently. I'm going to share some of those as we go along here. But the truth is, nobody much doubted young earth creationism or young earth cosmology. I'll use those terms interchangeably. Nobody much doubted that until a couple of hundred years ago. And a couple of hundred years ago, some of the scientists began to say, you know what? We think the earth is not thousands of years old. We think it's millions of years old. And then a little later, they said, no, we think it's billions of years old. And that caused some thinking Christians to say, well, maybe we need to reevaluate this chapter. So I understand, you know, where people are coming from when they disagree, but it seems to me that not only is it the most natural way to read the chapter, but I believe there's a lot of scientific evidence to back up a young earth creation viewpoint. And I'll share that a little bit of that in just a minute too. But I feel like I need to say that there are strong, conservative, Bible-believing Christians who are not young earth. Some of them teach the gap theory. You may be familiar with that. C.I. Schofield reference Bible. You know, some of you may have the Schofield study Bible. He popularized the gap theory, I think, among conservative Christians. And that says that between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, there may have been billions of years. And there's a little bit of biblical evidence for that, too. I'll talk about that in a minute, too. And then there's a day-age interpretation. You may be familiar with the day-age interpretation of Genesis 1. And they say, well, maybe the days of Genesis 1 really aren't 24-hour days. Maybe they represent long periods of time, maybe millions of years. And I think the most prominent advocate of day-age cosmology today is probably Hugh Ross. Are you familiar with Hugh Ross, any of you? He's got an organization which he calls Reasons to Believe. He's a very strong Christian man. He really is. But he disagrees with young earth creationists. And there have been some very godly men that may surprise you who have accepted and believe in old earth creationism. And that would include J.I. Packer. You familiar with J.I. Packer? Francis Schaeffer. You know, he's one of my heroes. William Lane Craig, very brilliant philosopher out there today. Does a lot of good work. Chuck Colson, Norm Geisler, Greg Kokel, C.S. Lewis, Bernard Ram, C.I. Schofield, Lee Strobel. These guys are old earth guys. They're not young earth creationists like I am. I also think I need to make clear here that when you talk about day-age creationism, that's not the same as theistic evolution. Those are two different things, and some people get those confused. Hugh Ross believes the universe is billions of years old, but he does not believe in theistic evolution. What he believes is that God, millions and millions of times over millions of years, has intervened to create every new species of life. So he still believes in creation, but he just believes it happened over billions of years. So he does not believe in evolution. Theistic evolutionists believe that Darwin basically got it right. That Darwin should be taken seriously, that things did evolve, but that somehow God was behind the evolution, kind of driving and guiding the evolution. So they see evolution as a real thing. They just see it as God-controlled.
Now what is that called?
Theistic evolution. Yeah, theistic evolution. course, there are lots of other ways to interpret Genesis 1. Some believe it's totally allegorical. You know, they say, well, this is just symbolic language. It's just poetic language. We're not supposed to take this literally, and they don't see it's a big deal. Some people believe that whoever wrote Genesis, and most of the time they don't believe Moses did it, simply borrowed from creation myths from other cultures and put together their own creation myth that was a mix of other creation myths. There are people who believe that. There was another interpretation, sort of, you might call it an interpretation. It was popular in the Southern Baptist Convention, our seminaries especially, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, several decades ago, because neo-orthodoxy was getting very strong in our seminaries. And they would say, well, the only parts of the Bible that really matter to us are the parts that tell us about salvation. So when you come to something in the Bible that's just supposed to be telling us about history or telling us about science, they say, the Bible's not a history book. The Bible's not a science book. We won't pay attention to that. If it's got errors there, no big deal. Scientific errors, historical errors, sure. We just don't care. And they kind of threw it out the window. Dangerous stuff, I think. That's the reason we had the Southern Baptist conservative resurgence, you know, because of that kind of thinking. Others see Genesis as written by men who had some experiences with God, but they were only inspired in a general sense, and they see these things written by fallible men. They just had creative imaginations, and so they don't take it very seriously. Now, in my humble opinion, people can be strong, conservative, Bible-believing Christians and accept, obviously, the literal young earth position. And again, that's where I am. But I believe they can also accept the gap theory, and I believe they can also accept the day-age theory, and probably even theistic evolution, although that sounds a little strange to me. It seems strange to me that anybody would claim to believe in theistic evolution, because the problem is, when you study this stuff, like evolution from a scientific perspective, and you're very open about it and honest about it, the evidence for evolution is so weak. It's really, really weak. It really is. Why would you feel a need to accept that and then say God did it? Many atheistic evolutionists, you can find these quotes all day long almost, will say things like, the evidence for what we believe is very weak, but it's all we've got. It's all. If you decide you're going to leave God out of the picture, how else do you explain things? You know, and that's the only thing they can come up with. So the evidence is pretty weak, and they acknowledge, many of them acknowledge it's weak, but they don't have any other explanation. So if you're going to accept God, many of them wonder, why would you do that? If you believe God did it, why on earth would you believe in evolution where there's not much evidence? The only reason we believe in it is because we're trying to write God out of it. Am I making sense here? So theistic evolution just seems like a real strange position to me. Although I have to admit, when I was very young, didn't have much sense, and I got overwhelmed by that biology teacher I had at UT. That's what I called myself for a while. I said, I'm a theistic evolutionist. It just sounded sophisticated. It was dumb, but that's where I was. That's what I said for a while. So, I think a lot of people have just been kind of overwhelmed by the sheer number of people out there who call themselves intellectuals and who've learned a big scientific vocabulary and they've studied all this stuff some and they've made up their mind there is no God and they've assured them that evolution is certainly true and that all real scientists accept it as scientific fact, and they've just been buffaloed by that. They've been overwhelmed by it. And I've talked about that before. I got an email some time back from somebody who had seen some of my stuff about creation. And he was very ugly. One of his comments was, evolution is a fact. Get over it. He didn't give any evidence. He just thought, everybody believes this, right? I mean, no, not right. Anyway.
Mr. Richard back said the Bible is a fact.
Yeah. But I think, like I said, young earthers have the advantage of using what I believe is the most natural, plain understanding of the creation narrative. I don't think anybody would have come up with the gap theory or the day-age theory or theistic evolution or these neo-orthodox ideas that the only thing that matters in the Bible is salvation stuff, not history stuff and not science stuff, if it weren't for the fact that a bunch of scientists a couple hundred years ago started claiming that it's ludicrous to believe in a young earth. And they started ridiculing people that believed in young earth. They'd scorn, they'd scoff, they'd laugh, they made fun of people. And so the intellectual Christians were feeling backed up. They didn't know the science. They didn't know the science. They didn't understand it. They just felt intimidated and thought, well, these guys are brilliant scientists, so maybe we just need to go along with them. I think that's what's happened.
They still do it.
It's still very common, yes. And I need to say that some of the evidence that the old earth people pull out can be a little bit daunting, especially when you first hear it. You might think, whoa, I don't know about that. But it's just good to be reminded that the young earth creationists have a lot of evidence too. Not just biblical evidence, although that's certainly there, but scientific evidence. You probably heard of the Institute for Creation Research, maybe. Those are all young earth scientists. They're all young earth scientists. I saw a page on their site that listed 14 scientific evidences for a young earth. 14. I saw another website, and he listed 22 of them, evidences for a young earth. We're talking about scientific evidence. And some of that gets a little technical. Some of it's hard to follow. But some of it, we can at least get the gist of it. Let me give you just a few of these. For example, you've seen pictures of galaxies, right? Some of them have these spiral arms. You know what I'm talking about? You see a picture of a galaxy and the arms kind of spiral around like that. Well, scientists have discovered that these stars are revolving in the galaxy around the core of the galaxy. And they say they're revolving so fast that the laws of physics seem to be a problem here for the evolutionists, because those things, if they were billions of years old like they claim they are, they would have lost their structure. They couldn't have kept that spiral arm structure. They call this the winding up dilemma. How did this happen? Well, young creationists say, well, it could happen if it's not that old, if it's kind of young. Makes sense. They also point out, the young earth people point out, that the earth's magnetic field is decaying. The scientists know that. It's decaying. And it's decaying so fast that they say it couldn't have been here for billions of years. It couldn't have been here that long because of the decay rate of the magnetic field on the earth. Are you aware that scientists have found soft tissue and bits of DNA in dinosaur bones that are supposed to be millions and millions of years old? And the scientists cannot understand that. They say, there's no way. Maybe soft tissue might last in the right circumstances a few thousand years, but millions and millions of years, no way. No way. So this is a problem. This is a problem for old Earth people. You probably are aware that the element carbon has an isotope, carbon-14, which is radioactive, has a half-life of 5,700 years. And what that means with a half-life of 5,700 years is if it's in rocks that are billions and billions of years old, that carbon-14 would have all disappeared. It just radiates away and turns the carbon-14 into nitrogen. So they say it could last at the most maybe 250,000 years. But so the scientists are saying 250,000 years is nothing. These rocks are billions of years old. But they found in coal and diamonds that are supposed to be billions of years old, the amount of carbon-14 that they would have expected if it was only a few thousand years old. Interesting. Scientists know how much sodium is being carried into the ocean by the world's rivers. And they know how much sodium's in the ocean. And they say, you know what? It doesn't match. If the Earth is supposed to be billions of years old, there should be a lot more sodium in the ocean. There's not enough sodium to account for billions of years. Same line of thinking is that there's not enough sediment in the ocean floors. The scientists said the rivers of the world are constantly bringing sediment into the ocean, and they look in the ocean, well, where is it? There's not enough sediment here for it to have been around that long. It doesn't make sense. Another little evidence that sometimes the young earth people will use is evolutionists say that men have been roaming the earth for 200,000 years. Hunters and gatherers, they said, you know, mankind's been around 200,000 years. And yet, even the evolutionists recognize, from their perspective, that men didn't learn how to do agriculture till about maybe 10,000 years ago. And that makes you scratch your head and you say, isn't it strange that they were roaming the earth for 190,000 years and didn't figure out that you could put seeds in the ground and grow crops? You know, I mean, it seems like they would have understood some agriculture. But that's kind of strange if it's that old. Another one kind of like that is evolutionists say that men have been recording historical events only a few thousand years. We know that. You know, only a few thousand years have we got any history at all. And yet, the evolutionists will claim that they found monuments and cave paintings and records of the moon phases and things like that that go back 200,000 years. And you say, well, if they were doing that 200,000 years ago, maybe we ought to be able to find a little more history, you know, somewhere in there. It's not there. It's a young Earth model. Any of you ever heard of radio halos? There's something scientists discovered. This was discovered while I was an undergraduate student at UT, and I got to meet the guy who saw this. Gentry was his name. But these are little tiny rings that they find in rocks that are caused by radioactive elements, radioactive materials, radioactive minerals. And those little rings provide evidence that the geological formation of those rocks happened virtually instantaneously, not molten over a period of many, many billions of years, because those halos wouldn't have been there. They wouldn't have made any mark like that. And by the way, I have read that those little halos have demonstrated that the decay rates of radioactive elements have not always remained constant. And if that's the case, that causes a problem with these radiometric dating techniques that scientists are always using to say that things are billions of years old. That's a problem. Here's another problem. Scientists have discovered that the moon is receding from the earth very, very slowly, very, very gradually, but little by little it's getting farther away from the earth. And they say if that's the case, that recession of the moon, there's no way it could have existed for billions of years for it to be going away like that. Those are just a few things that young earthers point out and say, here's a problem for you old earthers. You need to think about that. Now, I have to say that the old earthers will probably come up with answers for these things. That's why there's a debate. But I believe there's quite a bit of scientific evidence that supports young earth. But, of course, what about the biblical evidence? Well, one of the biblical arguments that I think is very strong and that a lot of young earthers use is that if it's an old earth, how did death get into the world? Sin of Adam, right? Sin came and then death. Romans 5:12 says, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin. That's how death got into the world. But if you're an old earth creationist, you have to believe that animals were dying for millions and millions and millions of years before Adam ever came on the scene. And to me, that's a little bit of a problem. You know, it's a theological problem. You know, how could there be all this death before there was any sin? Now, some of the old earthers will turn around and say, well, I'll tell you the answer to that. The answer is that Romans 5:12 talks about men dying, not about animals dying, and that animals could have been dying before sin. You know, and then young earthers might say, but God said His creation was very good. I mean, is that very good to have all these animals dying all this period of time? Is that what we call very good? And plus, you know what's going to happen in the end times when Jesus comes back, God restores all things? There are going to be animals there, but they're not going to be killing each other. The wolf's going to feed with a lamb. Remember, Isaiah told us that. The lion's going to eat straw like a bull. You know, that's what he says. So if he's going to do it then, it makes sense that they may have been doing it when God first created them until sin came into the picture. Romans 8, Paul talks about the entire creation groaning under the curse that came because of sin. You know, sin brought this on. And if the old earthers are right, again, you've got all this death and destruction and groaning in the world long before Adam and Eve ever come in the picture. So that's a problem for me. You remember when God gave Moses the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20? When he gave him the Sabbath commandment, he said this, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them. Did you hear that? He just goes right on and says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that's in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Sounds very much like he's talking about a literal week there, you know, when he created the world. In Mark chapter 10, Jesus said, but from the beginning of creation, this is Mark 10, 6, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Sounds like Jesus believed Adam and Eve were made at the beginning of creation, not millions and billions of years after the beginning of creation. Now, I feel like I need to take a little bit of time to just point out that those who believe that creation happened billions of years ago have their reasons. And here's one of them. They say, you know what? If astronomers are right, and most of the young earth creationists agree that astronomers are right about this, that these stars and galaxies are millions, and in some cases billions of light years away. They're that far away. If they're right about that, and the whole thing was created only a few thousand years ago, then there wouldn't be time for that light to get to us from them. You see? If they were created a few thousand years ago, their light wouldn't be anywhere close to us. We couldn't see them. So they say, how can that be true? They had to be created billions of years ago. And some of the young earthers have said, well, maybe light traveled faster in the early days of creation. And so that might be the answer, that got here really fast. The problem with that is, and a lot of young earthers don't like that explanation because the speed of light affects other things too. Do you remember Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared? Do you remember seeing that? E equals MC squared. Do you know what the C represents? C represents, anybody know? Speed of light. Yeah, speed of light. Speed of light. And it's a constant in the universe. The speed of light is a constant. One of the many constants in the universe that God put there. If it wasn't constant, then the ratio of mass to energy in the universe wouldn't be constant either. And that causes a lot of problems for the existence of the universe. So a lot of young earthers don't like that explanation. But others have said, well, why couldn't God have put the stars out there, the galaxies out there, and created the light between them and us, put all those photons out there too? I mean, he could have created it all at once, couldn't he? And I think, well, yeah, that's a good answer, I think. That's a reasonable answer. And then the old earthers will come back and say, well, wait a minute. Why would God create His universe like that to make us think it's old if it's really young? Isn't God being deceptive when He does things like that? And the young earthers might say, well, no more deceptive than if an angel could somehow come and carry us into the past and say, hey, there's Adam, guess how old he is? And you say, well, he looks like he's 25 or 30 years old to me. No, 2 minutes old. Well, he doesn't look 2 minutes old. Is that deceptive? I mean, he might point to a tree in the garden and say, how old do you think that tree is? I don't know, 50 years? Nope, it's 3 days old. You know, I mean, you know, that's the way God created it. He created the earth to look like it had some age to it. Yes, ma'am.
I'm with you in this. I'm a young earth purist. Mm-hmm. And my argument to anybody that says anything about it is, if God is, and I say God is the creator, and if he can make the earth, he can make the earth look old.
That's right.
Okay? That's my answer to that. If he could.
Yeah, he could.
God can make the earth look old, and he can make the dinosaurs look old.
He could. Some people have a problem with that because they say, well, it's not God's being deceptive. Why would he make it look old if it isn't old? But I thought, you know, in terms of the stars and galaxies out there, maybe God created the universe of such immense size that we would be awed by him and his ability and his genius and his power to create such a monstrously huge universe. But the only way for us to know about it was to do what we said earlier, create the light so we could see these things and see how far they are away. Not to deceive us, but to impress us with the immense size of the universe.
Several years ago, when I was a lot younger, it hadn't been too long when they got the Hubble telescope. And Hubble sent back pictures, a series of pictures that convinced the scientists, I mean a whole bunch of them, it's a group, and it was a big write-up on the paper, and they decided because of the series of pictures that they have made a conclusion that the Earth was really 15 billion years younger than what they thought it would have been, or they concluded it was before these pictures. So if with the series of pictures that this telescope sent back, they can shave off 15 billion years.
Wow.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
Make
yeah.
A conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And a series of pictures, yeah. 15 billion years.
Yeah. And we tend to be a little bit too overwhelmed at scientists who claim to have these assured results that this is the way things are. And we should know by now that they so often change their minds. I mean, scientists now laugh at what scientists believed a few hundred years ago, and back then they were just as sure, you know. So it's the way things work. So, yeah. Some old Earth people will say, wait a minute, are you telling me that in one 24-hour period, Adam was able to tend the garden, name all the animals, have a rib removed, and marry Eve all in one day? And the young earthers might say, well, yeah, he may not have named all the animals. It says he named the animals God brought to him. And God may not have brought every single animal on that very day. He may have brought the ones that he thought Adam might consider to be possible helpers. But maybe later on he named the rest of them. The old earth guys will sometimes say, yeah, we are interpreting Genesis 1 in light of what scientists are telling us now the universe is like, what science has discovered. And then they'll say, but that's what Christians have always done. We all do that with other verses. And they'll use passages like the earth being fixed and immovable. In Isaiah, I think it is, and several Psalms and 1 Chronicles, there are several verses that talk about the earth being fixed and immovable. And they say, now we know that's not true. The earth's moving around the sun all the time. It's in orbit. It's not fixed and immovable. But young earthers would tend to respond, well, it's fixed in relation to us. And it's fixed in relation to its orbit. It's doing what God put it there to do. You know, it's fixed in terms of God's organization. And we could even say, there's some figures of speech. You know, we talk about the sun rising and setting, and we all know what that means. That's not necessarily an error. And maybe in this case, God's just simply saying, there's some things men can't change. And one of them is the earth. You're not going to change the orbit of the earth. You're not going to change it. It's fixed. It's immovable. You're not going to mess with it. Let me say this, too. I've mentioned several ways Genesis 1 can be interpreted. But I feel like that we probably ought to practice putting these into two camps, basically. One camp says that science can explain it all without God. There are an awful lot of people out there who are in that camp. They think they can explain the universe, the earth, life, all without God. They're called naturalists, by the way, or materialists. They leave God out of the picture completely. And I feel like I need to say, very gently and very lovingly, God calls people who leave him out of their calculations, will you tell me, what does he call them?
Fools.
Fools, yeah, fools. He says they're fools. I don't have to call them fools. God's done that. He said, that's what you are. If you leave me out of it, you're a fool. And that may sound ugly to some people, but that's just what God says. The other camp, of course, and I think this includes me, of course, the young earth creationists, the day-age people, the gap theory people, probably the theistic evolutionists, even though they seem strange to me, but they would all say, no, none of this could be here without a creator. It couldn't have just happened. Couldn't have just happened. Some of them may accept billions of years. Some of them, I may scratch my head and say, I can't understand where you're at there. But they're really trusting Jesus. They really do believe God's the creator. They really do believe the Bible, except when they come here, they think they've got to make a different understanding of this. And I have a problem with that, but I think we have to be gracious with them just because they disagree with us. We may think they're mistaken, but I see the whole field separated into creationists on one hand and the naturalists on the other. And I think we need to make that distinction very clear. We don't want to be biting and hurting each other in these things, and sometimes we do that. And I think we've got to be careful about that. Yes, and some of the old earth creationists will use that verse, you're right. And I personally think that verse is talking about something else, that it doesn't mean we should interpret it as 1,000 years. I think it's talking about the fact that time is just nothing to God, you know. I mean, we might think 1,000 years is a long time, but to God it's not. You know, I think that's what he's saying there, but you're right, that's the verse they use. Paul wrote Romans, of course, and in chapter 1 he was inspired to write this, and he's talking about the naturalist here. He's talking about the naturalist. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, listen to this, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. They suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, here it is again, they became fools. So there's the explanation. And we see that in spades in our culture today, all over the world. So many men claiming to be wise, but they're suppressing the truth. And God says, you're fools. You're fools. And if the people in Paul's day were without excuse for not recognizing the Creator, and they were without excuse, men have always been without excuse for not recognizing the Creator. But today, I'm telling you guys, some people think today science has explained. No. Today, there is less excuse than ever for refusing God, for saying, I'm not going to let God in the door. I mean, we've talked before in here about what men have discovered in the last few decades. And the field of molecular biology is just virtually shouting, there has to be a creator. I mean, it's just so awesome. Some of you heard me say some of these things before, but they're so strong, I think it's just worth repeating. Before the 20th century, the molecular makeup of a living cell was a closed book. Nobody could understand it. Nobody knew what was there. It was just a little bit of jelly as far as they were concerned. And now, God's let men peer into that cell and see what's there. And it blows us away. It's more like a city. It's not a blob of jelly. All these incredible machines. Hundreds of trillions of atoms in every single cell. And they all have to be in the right place, doing the right thing. Machines and little trucks and things carrying information. It's just amazing what God's put in that cell. A million, billion atoms, everyone in its proper place. You got the DNA molecules. And by the way, sometimes people get this idea that DNA molecules are simple. They're not. And some people get the idea that they can reproduce themselves. They can't. Because you've seen pictures on TV of it unwinding and more forming. But it can't do that on its own. It's got to have a whole big support system there before it can do it. But anywhere from 10 billion to 200 billion atoms in one of those DNA molecules. And it's like a library of information. That's what it's there for. It's got all this information of how this living organism is supposed to function. How it's supposed to look. How it's supposed to be built. Where every part's supposed to be. It's all right there in that DNA. And there would have to be hundreds of proteins in that little cell. And every one of those has thousands of atoms, all just in the right place, doing the right thing. And when they try to come up with the simplest imaginable cell, they say, all this stuff has to be there, and there's no way to make it simpler, and it can't reproduce if you make it any simpler. And it's just, it couldn't have evolved one part at a time. You can't have this protein evolving, and this protein evolving, and this enzyme evolving, and somehow, they've got to have each other to get put together. For example, every cell, before it can reproduce, has to have a membrane to protect it. How does it get a membrane? It's got to have a membrane to synthesize proteins. But it can't have a membrane until it has proteins. You got to have both at the same time. There's a translational system in the cell that gets that information that's in that DNA molecule and takes it out to the rest of the cell to build proteins. These are enzymes that are being used in the cell. But those enzymes can't be built without that translational system already in place. But they're what's doing the translation. It's got to happen all at once. And so you've got all these interdependent parts of the cell, thousands, millions, billions, trillions of atoms in a cell, hundreds of trillions, and they're all in the right place. And because they're so interconnected and interdependent, it would have had to just pop into existence all at once. Give me a break. I mean, really, Michael Denton, he's one of these molecular biologists, and he said this, I love this quote, he said, "The complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it's impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together suddenly by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event. Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle." That's what it is. It's a miracle. God did it. And people just don't want to look at it. I'd like to mention one other thing today that God's built into His universe to provide, I think, just stunning evidence that He's the Creator. It's just awesome. It just blows me away.
Remember the laminin?
Yes, the laminin is a beautiful illustration. If you've not seen that sermon, what was the name of that message? Do you remember?
How great is God.
Yeah. And I can't even say His name right now. Giglio. Yeah, yeah. If you haven't seen that message, you can probably find it on YouTube. It's worth seeing. It's an awesome message. Yeah, the laminin. I don't want to spoil it, but but the laminin just says, wow, this is God. This is the only thing it could be. Yeah, it's awesome. But God has chosen some incredible things to let us see in these last days, I think, to see His awesome creative power. And one of the things He's done, and He did it from the beginning, men just didn't understand it until a few decades ago we began to see this. But He's put into His universe certain constants and ratios and rates, you know, physical constants and ratios and rates, that have been there all along. And the universe can't exist unless these things are very, very, very incredibly precise. If they're off just a little bit, the universe couldn't exist. Life couldn't exist. They have to be perfectly tuned. You say, what are you talking about? Well, I'm talking about things like, a lot of things we don't understand very well, like the forces, the forces in the universe, the nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, gravitational force, electromagnetic force. All these things have constants associated with them, and we know what they are. We can figure out what they are. We figured them out over the past several hundred years, actually. There's a ratio of electromagnetic force to the gravitational force constant. There's a ratio of protons to electron masses. There's a ratio of the number of protons to the number of electrons in the universe. There's a ratio of proton to electron charge. There's the expansion rate of the universe. There's the mass density of the universe. There's the baryon density in the universe, protons and neutrons. There's the speed of light. There's the average distance between galaxies. There's the average distance between galaxy clusters. There's an average distance between stars. And on and on and on you can go. About 10 years ago, Hugh Ross listed 93 of these. The other day I read that now scientists recognize over 200 of these parameters. And they all have to be tuned to an incredible precision. For example, I read this the other day. The ratio of the number of protons to the number of electrons has to be precise to this precision. One part in 10 to the 37th power. One part in 10 to the 37th power. You say, well, how much is that? I'm not going to be able to explain it, and we cannot absorb it. I can just tell you it's very, very tiny. But Hugh Ross came up with an illustration that might help just a little bit. I like it. He said, let's imagine an area of land covered with dimes. And let's, first of all, start with an area of 1 square mile of land covered with dimes. And we're going to cover it with dimes 2 feet deep. Or 1 square mile, that's a pretty big area of dimes. He said that would cover the amount of money we'd need to pay off the federal debt. Okay, that's a big number. We all know that's a big number. All right. Now, he said, not instead of 1 square mile, let's suppose we've got the whole North American continent. The whole continent. And we'll cover it with dimes not 2 feet, not 2 miles, but all the way to the moon, 239,000 miles. And let's say we have 1 billion other continents the same size as North America. And we put dimes on those continents to go all the way to the moon. And then we take one of those dimes and all those billions of continents with dimes going all the way to the moon, paint it red, mix it in the mix, and say, now go pick it first time. The chances of doing that are 1 in 10 to the 37th power. I mean, you know, our imagination is just bogged down. We can't grasp. But we know that that's incredible precision. I mean, it's incredible precision. Here's another one. Secular scientists, we all acknowledge now the universe had a beginning. They call it the Big Bang. And I know a lot of Christians, let me just chase a little rabbit here for just a second. A lot of conservative Christians, we will mock and ridicule the idea of a Big Bang. And I understand, because to some of us, it seems like we're taking God out of the picture and saying, well, there's just a Big Bang out there, but no God. And many of them try to do that. But I need to say, and we need to know, that when scientists first began to realize that the laws of physics required that this universe had a beginning, it was a big problem for the atheists. That was a major problem. Because the thinking atheists, anyway, knew that if the universe had a beginning, it has to have a cause. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. Everything that has a beginning has a cause. If the universe had a beginning, it had to have a cause. And now some of the atheists will say, well, you're just moving it back one step. I mean, you're saying there's a God who created the universe, but then the question becomes, what's the cause behind God? And the answer is pretty simple. God didn't have a cause because God didn't have a beginning. You know, I mean, that's pretty easy. But it is true. Everything that has a beginning has to have a cause. But God doesn't have to have a cause because He doesn't have a beginning. He just always exists. He always has. He always will. But secular scientists say that by the laws of physics, understanding what they do, if the initial explosion of the Big Bang, as they understand it, differed in strength by as little as 1 part in 10 to the 60th power, they said, either the universe would have just collapsed back on itself, or it would have expanded so rapidly that stars couldn't form, and of course there wouldn't have been any life. So they're scratching their heads saying, how can this be? One scientist said, 1 in 10 to the 60th, that's like firing a bullet at a 1-inch target on the other side of the universe, 20 billion light years away, and hitting a 1-inch target. We try to come up with illustrations like this to help our brains get around it, but we still can't. You know, we just can't. So the point is, we have all these parameters, all these constants, all these rates, all these ratios, and it's like God has fine-tuned them. Every one, every single one of them, to a very fine, precise degree, so that when we look at it, we will just drop our jaws and say, how can this be? There must be an incredibly brilliant, genius God out there who did this. And can you say it's just pure chance? Well, yeah, you can say it. You can say anything you want to say, but it seems totally absurd to say it. The only logical explanation is that there's an incredibly brilliant, powerful God out there who put this together so that we could discover it and give Him glory, and just be awed at what He's done. People need to know this stuff. Our kids need to know this stuff. That's what we're trying to do, Veritas. Help me pray about that. Struggling with it right now. But I'm afraid we're living in a day when mental discipline is kind of in short supply. Not a lot of mental discipline out there. We've got a lot of people loving the Lord with all their hearts, but not with all their minds. And it's a problem. It's easier just to go with the flow. I think of a character on Scooby-Doo, I think it was. He said, like, dude, I don't want to have to think so much. It hurts my head, you know. I'm afraid we've got a lot of people like that today. But God's done so many awesome things for us to see. And so many of us just don't have a clue. We don't have a clue. And it's sad. I think it takes a blind, dogged, stubborn commitment to methodological naturalism for a thinking person to say, I'm not going to let God in this picture. But that's what scientists are doing. They don't want a God out there who will hold them accountable. That's the big thing, I think. And God says, you're fools. You're being fools. Some of them, of course, suspect there might be a God out there behind all this, but they're afraid they'll lose their jobs if they buck the system, so they just keep quiet.
Or the grant money.
Yeah, that's out there, too. That's a big factor. Here's what God says about it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. By the way, let me take just a minute. Well, we're out of time, aren't we? Oh, my goodness. Those who advocate the gap theory, some of you may be gap theory people, let me say a couple of things. The Hebrew word for without form is tohu. Tohu. So the earth was tohu. It was without form. But they'll point out that over in Isaiah 45:18, we read this. For thus saith the Lord, who created the heavens, God Himself, that formed the earth and made it. He has established it. And listen to this. He created it not, and then there's that Hebrew word again, tohu. He created it not in vain, tohu. not without form. He formed it to be inhabited. And they'll say, see, it wasn't created tohu, it became tohu. Okay, maybe. I mean, they'll also point out that the word was in verse 2 could sometimes be translated became. And so they'll conclude that maybe there were millions and billions of years between verse 1 and verse 2. So the gap theory will use that argument. Some of you may land there. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness He called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So on day one, God creates light. And right out of the chute, we have a problem. Because everybody knows that light comes from the sun, right? I mean, that's where we get light on, just from the sun. But He doesn't make the sun to the fourth day, right? So, interesting, He made the plants on the third day before the sun. And one of the interesting things about that is, it doesn't take a scientist to figure that out, right? I mean, when Adam was created, Adam could tell that when the sun went down, it got dark. When the sun came up, it got light. When he went into a cave, it got dark. There was no sun there. When he stood behind a tree, it got shady. You know, he knew the light came from the sun. That wasn't a mystery. So why would he write it this way? I mean, it seems strange, doesn't it? Didn't he know that light comes from the sun? But some people say that maybe it means that God created the sun in verse 1, and then He just had clouds over the earth, and then He kind of gradually parted them, and then when He gets to day 4, He parts them completely so the sun can be seen. The problem with that is, the language there in day 4 sounds like He's just now creating them. He's making them. He's setting them in the sky, not that He's revealing them. So why would Moses write it like this? Maybe it's because the sun wasn't there yet. Maybe it's because God really did create light first. Maybe it's because God wanted us to realize, you don't need the sun for light. You need Me. I'm the light. I'm the source of light. And I want you to know that that sun that you think gives light, I don't want you worshiping that thing. It's not the source of light. I am. I'll create it in a few days. Right now, just realize I'm the source of light. Do you realize that in the end, in Revelation 22:5, when the new heavens and the new earth have been created, God's going to say, there's no need for the sun now. Why? Because the Lord's the light. He's the light. You don't need the sun anymore. Maybe we didn't need it in the beginning either. You know, God's the source of light. Well, I'd love to go on. I'm going to have to stop. Father, thank You so much for this time we've had together. Thank You for Your Word. We just want to worship You, God. We want to stand in awe of You. You are an awesome Creator. Thank You that You've given us so much evidence in Your creation and in Your Word to cause us to just say, wow, what a God You are. You are awesome beyond words. Our little brains can't begin to fathom it. So, Lord, thank You that You've left us with all this evidence, and thank You that You've told us to worship You. We want to learn how to do that really well, and we want to be able to pass these things on to others who are walking in darkness and who are oblivious and who are blind, and to our kids who are just being inundated with lies and false stuff coming out of a system in the world that's opposed to You. Lord, please help us to know how to communicate these things better and get glory for Yourself. And we just want to walk in Your light and enjoy Your light and know that one of these days we know it's all going to be wrapped up. We're going to be with You forever. We're going to be rejoicing in new glorified bodies. And it's all going to be clear at that point. But Lord, we want to do what You created us to do between now and then. So help us to represent You well. Help us to walk full of Your Holy Spirit and to be good examples and represent Jesus to a lost world around us and get glory through us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you guys. Thanks for coming.